you know, and I know a lot of you were here for our Ephesians study, and so you've heard some of my kind of, you know, testimony along the way. And it just so happens that it was this book that started the grace awakening in my life. And so it's a very special book for me personally. Contemplative prayer is what we're going to kind of get an introduction to tonight. But Brother Lawrence is in the historical, in the Christian historical development of contemplative prayer. He was a Carmelite monk, a 17th century French Carmelite monk. And I'll tell you more about that when I get to him in the way of introduction. But it just so happens that my PhD research was about the development of the beginning of contemplative prayer in Christianity. So you're going to hear some of that tonight. And if it bores you, you can, you know, once I email everybody, you can email me back and say, hey, stay off the pinheaded academic stuff because it bores me. You know, I always tell everybody when I do get the chance to teach in a Bible college, seminary, or, you know, just a secular university, I have students all the time come up to me and say, man, I thought church history was going to be boring. And I always tell them, my job is to make it exciting, to make you want to learn. You know, don't you wish all your professors in school were like that? I mean, I had some teachers that could have stood a little dose of enthusiasm. And, of course, I'm passionate about church history, so, you know, I hope it is kind of contagious. For starters, we want to consider that contemplative prayer is a type of prayer. And most of us don't think of this in these terms, but usually we think, well, you know, do you pray? And when someone asks me that, and I've been asked that point blank by a number of people if they, anyway, especially pastors that I've had in my life, you know, how many hours a day do you pray, young man? And I always want to be a kind of a smart guy, you know, and say, well, what kind of prayer are you talking about? Yeah. And so you can see, I mean, because if you think about it, thanksgiving is a type of prayer, isn't it? Praise. Historically, Christianity has considered what we call praise in the 20th and 21st century. Christianity didn't call it praise. They just called it prayer or singing. You know, that our terminologies have changed a bit, but praise is a form of prayer. Petition, we all know that. Lord, help me with this. I need you to do this. And that's when I'm praying for myself, is petition. Intercession is when I'm petitioning on your account or on someone else's account. Lord, you know, where'd Peyton go, man? I was about to use him. He's gone. You know, intercession might be, Lord, bless Peyton with a job. Or, you know, you could be praying for me. Lord, bless Al with the next step in his journey. Because right now I'm in a period of transition yet again. So intercession, praying for others. Confession, we talked a lot about that, and that's just simply, you know, confessing your sins or your weaknesses to God. I put on here Psalter. Anybody raised in a liturgical church, especially a Catholic, Anglican? You know, I think I mentioned in our study of Ephesians that I've spent, you know, half a dozen opportunities where I went and stayed in monasteries and worshiped with monks, and that's what they call reading the Psalter. You and I would call praying through the Psalms, using the Psalms. I mean, well, you know, gosh, I hate to do this kind of, you know, this goes back to what Keith and I were talking about, you know, how we have to be careful not to judge other believers in other parts of the world or in other centuries or whatever. And I think I shared in our last class that, you know, here I was in this monastery and I was trying real hard to, you know, to really make this. I grew up in a liturgical church, and so liturgy doesn't just, by definition, turn me off. I'll never forget after I was, you know, really born again and filled with the Holy Spirit, and I went back to this, you know, first First United Methodist Church of, you know, any town USA, where all the, you know, rich people went and the country clubbers went. And I was sitting up in the balcony. I'll never forget the very first time that they sang the doxology and recited the Apostles' Creed. It was all I could do to keep from raising my hands, because the liturgy that I'd grown up with suddenly made sense. And it was alive. Well, you know, praying through the Psalms or reading the Psalter, that's what it's supposed to be. And, you know, like I said, I would struggle because I would see the monks, you know, and they looked really deadpan. Of course, you know, if I had to do that 3 times a day, every day for about 10 years, I might get the same way. So guess what? Maybe you shouldn't do it every day, 3 times a day for 10 years. Do something different. And anyway, and contemplative prayer. So contemplative prayer is just another type of prayer. If we could get the next slide there, Justin. What I want to do is give you as fast as I can some historical background for contemplative prayer. Now, I'm going to warn you right away, I'm going to read some non-biblical sources, some that perhaps you haven't heard referenced in church before. And I want to do it in a way that I hope helps you to understand and gives you an appreciation for what God has done throughout history in the lives of men and women, in mankind. One of the chief examples of contemplative prayer throughout Christian history is Moses. And I've noted them on here. You remember Moses when he when he ascends the mountain, Mount Sinai, to get the law. He didn't know he's going to get the law, but he's going to go up on the mountain. And in the Exodus account, if you remember, and I've noted it here, it says that God would speak to Moses face to face, as a man would with his friend. Throughout Christian history, that whole concept of Moses being on the mountain, meeting with God, is a picture of contemplative prayer, of what our relationship with Christ can be now. Now, you know, obviously in the Old Testament, no, they didn't think everybody had that kind of access, but we do, right? The writer of the Hebrews says that Jesus is the new Moses. He's better than Moses. He's better than Abraham. He's better than the Old Testament. He's better than the tabernacle. He's better than the sacrifices and the high priest. Jesus is better than, and we have that kind of access with Him. That face-to-face is also an important passage in the Apostle Paul. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. For now we see, and I'm going to touch on this as we go, but in the Greek, now we see through a glass in enigma, but then we shall see Him. Well, we will know Him because we will see Him face to face. And it's a reference all the way back to Moses meeting with God on the mountain. It's interesting in that Exodus account, because God says, no one will see My face and live. And yet Moses somehow apparently did. Now, there is the story where, you know, Moses says, I want to see you. And God says, well, you can't look on My face or else you'll die. So I'm going to hide you in the cleft of the rock. And, you know, I'm going to walk by you. And while I'm walking by you, I'm going to put My hand up in front of your face. And, you know, apparently so Moses is supposed to sit there, but he can't stand it. And he turns and looks and he sees the hinder parts of God as he walks by him. Now, I'm smiling and I don't mean that to mean that I don't believe it or I'm making light of it. It's interesting when you read the Old Testament, you hear, I mean, this is, remember we talked about last week, anyone who was here at the end, this is Yahweh, this is the God who created all things, is walking by Moses, putting His hand in his face. I don't know, it's funny to me when I think of that. Now, you know, I believe that was pre-incarnate Christ. I believe Jesus is the one we read about in the Old Testament. There's great debate about that. A lot of my friends disagree with me strongly, but that's how I interpret it, that Jesus is the bodily form of God. So anyway, another interesting thing that comes out in the life of Moses is, and we'll touch on this in the next coming weeks, is that Moses, it's said in Exodus, you know, the cloud, the mountain. Anybody been to Israel? Anybody been to Israel? You been to Israel? It's amazing. I mean, I've only been once, and I didn't go on a biblical, you know, I went on a business trip, and, you know, one of my colleagues drove me around the day before I had to start working. It's amazing. I never dreamed that Israel would have snow-capped mountains, but it does. They have snow skiing in northern Israel, you know, which is, I just never dreamed that would be the case. It is likely that the mountain that Moses, the mountain that we're talking about is actually not in Israel, it's in Egypt, or it's on the road to Israel. You know, I don't even remember where Sinai is now. I don't think it's in Israel, is it? Anyway, it gives you the picture of like a volcanic eruption, because, you know, the Old Testament story, fire is coming, fire and brimstone, and great thick cloud covers the mountain. But that's the interesting part, is that the Exodus account says that Moses ascends the mountain and he enters into the darkness. He enters into this clouded area where no one can see beyond it to meet with God. And so the spiritual writers in Christianity have always made a real point about that it's in darkness that we see God face to face. And it's kind of an enigma, isn't it? It's kind of a paradox that you see in the midst of cloud and darkness. Anyway. I'm sorry? It's in Saudi Arabia. Thank you. I'm not an archaeologist or geologist. I don't know. So I guess the mountain I saw in Israel might have been Tabor. Tabor, how do you say it? Tabor. I don't even know. I didn't get very close to it. I saw it, you know, way, way out in the distance as I was riding up the Golan Heights, getting behind the concrete barricades. As you're going up, you know, I don't know. I shouldn't even go to this, but, you know, the Jordan River is, I mean, it's hard not to laugh. You know, if you grew up in the South and you grew up with the Tennessee or the Mississippi, you know, the Jordan River is like a little creek. I mean, it's literally, you could jump across it half the time. You know, there are places where it gets wider, but especially going into the Golan Heights, it's just this little trickling stream that you could, you know, I could easily step over it, you know. So we're going up and I'm looking at down in this ravine at the Jordan River, and there's these big concrete barricades, you know, and I'm with my friend Frank, who's driving around. I said, Frank, what are these concrete barricades for? And he goes, oh, that's where you get behind if you encounter sniper fire. And I was like, are you serious? I mean, I started laughing, and he goes, yeah, I'm serious. From time to time, people in Jordan will shoot at Israelites, you know, Israelis driving up the highway. So when that happens, you about every 100 yards is a concrete barricade, and you get behind it so that you don't get shot to death. So we'll move on from there. The next influence, and you know, you're gonna is go ahead, put it up there. Is Plato? Why Plato? Everybody remembers the story of Socrates, right? He's the the Greek philosopher. He's executed because he's teaching against the polytheism in the Greco-Roman world. He's teaching his disciples that there's not many gods, there's one God. If you didn't know that, that's why he was killed, because he was teaching what they believed were treacherous teachings. And so Plato is how we learn about Socrates. It's really interesting because it's in Plato's Republic where he's talking about the perfect society and what the perfect society would be like. And in that, he talks about, and he goes through all kinds of things about what, you know, every aspect of society. But one of the things he talks about is the highest calling. What would be the highest calling in the perfect society? It would be the role of the philosopher. And then he describes what a philosopher is. And you and I would realize, if you read Plato, that the philosopher is like a preacher. Anybody saw the movie The Matrix? Who saw The Matrix? Okay. I didn't see any but the first one. I don't like to watch all the sequels, you know. But the first one I really liked. But it came out when I was in Scotland. And when I had all my friends, you know, emailing me, oh man, the Matrix. And it was really big here. And, you know, and they were all telling me, you got to see The Matrix. You know, it's an analogy of Christianity. And when I started watching it, I was sitting there with my kids and I said, this is Plato's analogy of the cave. Anybody familiar with the analogy of the cave in Plato's Republic? Anybody? I love it when I tell people things they don't know. Not that one. That's the thunder. I don't want the thunder yet. Go back. There, thank you. Plato in Book 7 of the Republic talks about, and it's known now as the analogy of the cave. He says, if you read Plato, it's all dialogue. You know, Socrates asks a question, and then his students try to respond, and then he asks them another question. That's why it's called the Socratic method. He's teaching them mainly by asking them questions and trying to get them to think from A to Z to get to where he wants them to go. And half the time they don't get it, and he makes fun of them, and then he ends up telling them what he wants them to know. But anyway, he says the world is like these two men who are in a cave. And for the sake of illustration, says Socrates, these two men are sitting on the ground and they're tied to a pole. You know, they're tied to a pole with their hands behind their back, their feet are tied, and their head is tied so they can't look to the right or to the left. All they can do is stare straight ahead. And they know that each other's there because they can talk to each other, but they can't even see each other. In front of these men is a big tarp, like a curtain. And on the other side of the curtain, several feet beyond that, is a big bonfire. They're in this deep, dark cave. And what happens is there are men moving things around in between the curtain and the fire, and so the shadows of these men get cast on the curtain. And so these men are sitting there staked, you know, tied up, talking to each other, and they see shapes passing, the shadows of these men, and, you know, carrying all kinds of different objects. And Plato says, this is the only existence they know. I mean, for the sake of my illustration, they didn't have a childhood. This is all they know are the shadows that pass in front of them, and these two men talk and try to figure out what is it. They hear people talking on the other side of this curtain, and so they recognize a shape goes by. They recognize that it's a person like me. I'm sitting there, but since I can't see anything, I don't even know what I look like, right? And so. And then these men, you know, Socrates says, you know, let's say they're putting a set together for a big play, and he actually uses the example. What if a man brings the only word I know to use is an icon, because that's the word that Socrates uses in the Greek. He brings an icon of a giraffe. You know, now you and I immediately, I'm thinking of cut out a cardboard figure of a giraffe to use as a prop in a play. And the men are talking about these items as they're pulling them. And Socrates says, what are those men going to think a man looks like? Well, they're going to think he looks like a shadow. Okay, what are they going to think a giraffe looks like? Kind of an extension of that man with a big old head. And Socrates says, that's what the world is like. Our world that we live in is only a shadow of the real world. But we can't know the real world until we die. Everything on the earth is a shadow of a reality in heaven. And he says, what if someone came up to one of those men and untied them and drug them up the long steep incline to the mouth of the cave into the bright sunshine? What would that man be like? And they all, you know, I'm kind of going to give you the shortest version I can. They would say, well, he wouldn't be able to see because he's used to a real dark and dim environment. And Socrates says, exactly. He would shut his eyes out of sheer pain. He wouldn't be able to take the intensity of the sunlight. Eventually, though, his eyes would become accustomed to it. And what would he think? And they said, well, he would see the world as it really is. He would see men as they really are. He would see giraffes, and he would realize. And Socrates goes, wouldn't he be angry? And they say, why? Because he thought the world was flat. He thought it was nothing but the shadow that he had experienced, and now he realizes the world is so much bigger. It's vibrant. It's full of color. It's full of three dimensions. And that man would, and he said, what do you think would fill that person? And the Socrates and students say, well, he would be excited. He would think, wow, the world is so different and so beautiful compared to what I knew. And Socrates said, exactly. And that's what the world is like. The world that we live in is the cave. Eternity is what I just described to you. That's what eternity is. And then Socrates says, what if after a man had lived outside the cave for a while, what if they told him, now you have to go back into the cave and be tied up again? And they said he wouldn't do it. He would resist it until his death. And Socrates says, exactly. Once you see, and Socrates refers to God as the good, once you see and understand the good, you can't accept everything that is lesser than that. And he said, but that's what the philosopher has to do. The philosopher is the person who has seen the world and seen eternity and knows the reality of it, but they have to live in the confines of the here and now to teach others when they're looking at the shadows to help get them convinced that though all you see is shadows, this is not reality. There's a bigger reality out there. And that's Socrates. That's the analogy of the cave. I don't know. Does that make sense why I believe the Matrix is based on the analogy of the cave? Okay. Now, I do believe that's also an analogy for Christianity. I believe it's very much an analogy of Christianity. Okay. And then there's the pinnacle. And now you can put the next slide up. There's the pinnacle of Socrates and Plato in Plato's Timaeus. This is the most quoted verse from Plato in all the church fathers. And I should have told you that from the start. Is that the early church fathers read Plato. And they didn't believe Plato was to be rejected. Not all of them. Some of them did. But some of them embraced Plato and believed that he was like Moses to the Greeks. The guy that I studied, Clement of Alexandria, said, just as Moses was the great prophet for the Israelites, Plato was the great prophet for the Gentiles. And indeed, when you read... What? The next slide? Yeah, give me the next slide. When you read in Timaeus, this quote by Plato, Socrates saying it apparently, for it is both a difficult task to discover the father and maker of this universe, and having found him, it is impossible to declare him to everyone. This verse was quoted more than any other verse out of Plato by the church fathers, and you can see why. There's another place, can't remember if it's in Timaeus, Republic, or one of the other writings, but there's one place where Plato, and I kind of did a brief search for it today, and I gave up because I had to do some other things. But there's a place where Plato also says, if God is our Father, then he certainly must have a son to show us what he's like. How many of you ever heard that before? When I started reading Plato, I have to tell you, I got a little frustrated that we don't ever hear about him in Christianity. I believe that these Greek philosophers were reaching out for God for eternity. I mean, think about when they're writing. They're writing 6 centuries before Jesus. If the maker of the universe is our Father, because that was a view in the Greco-Roman world by philosophers, was that there was a creator and that he was our Father. We were all his children. And so Plato says, if he is our Father, he must certainly have a son to reveal himself to us. You know, I just find that amazing. I hope I'm right about the time frame. I think it's 6 centuries before. It might have been 3 now that I think about it. But that's way out of my league. See, mine is first 3 centuries of Christian era. I could have looked it up, but I was too lazy. I didn't think I would try to tell you when it happened. But anyway, the point of bringing all that up about Plato is because one of the things I want you to realize is that Plato is one of the beginning writers in the ancient world that talks about contemplation. What we think of, you know, what becomes extended into contemplative prayer. What Plato says, and there's another thing I like what he says. He says, look, why are the stars in the sky? You know, when you look up into the sky and you see all these vast stars, why are they up there? And, you know, his followers, I don't know, they're nice to look at. He said, no. First of all, when you look at the stars, you're looking up. And when you're looking up, you're not stuck in this world. You're beginning to gaze into eternity when you look at the stars. So Plato says the stars are there to draw our eyes and our minds to the eternal values that are behind this world. And he says what you can do if you look into the stars, I'm kind of giving you the layman's translation. Plato says if you'll look into the stars and you contemplate the eternity, you can see beyond the stars. And what he's talking about is opening your heart and mind to the Creator that made everything. And isn't that what the Old Testament tells us? The Old Testament says that all of creation sings to the glory of God. All creation sings His praise. And the idea is, as we, as non-believers, as people in Africa and India right now who've never heard the gospel, Pastor Glenn makes some statements Sunday about this, you know, which I thought were pretty bold, about how other religions, you know, can actually point someone. And I agree with him. I agree with that concept that God is constantly reaching out to men and women across the face of the earth. Now, I also liked how Pastor Glenn kind of summarized it by saying all these other things may point to Jesus, but there's only one way to salvation, and that is through Jesus. And I liked him putting that cap on it. But the point is, Socrates and Plato are saying, look, open your mind to go beyond this world. That's the only way to get out of being stuck in time and space. You know? And that was the beginning of understanding this idea of contemplation. Okay, now I'm going to go the next step, and that is Philo the Jew. Anyone ever heard of Philo the Jew? Philo of Alexandria. I happen to have the exhaustive works of Philo. I was going to read out of here, but the text is so darn small that I typed it on the slide because I didn't want to try to read it out of here. Philo is a contemporary of Jesus and a contemporary of Josephus. You know, anybody heard of Josephus? He's a Roman, he's a Jewish historian living contemporaneously with Jesus in the first century, and it's through Josephus that we know about Israel and the scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees and the Essenes and all these kind of things. Only through Josephus do we really understand, other than outside the New Testament, it's our best historical documentation. Well, Philo is living in Alexandria, Egypt, in the same time frame. Philo is unique because this was going back to our Ephesians study. Philo speaks Greek and reads Greek. He doesn't read Hebrew, so he cannot read the Hebrew Old Testament. If you've heard this before, the Greek version of the Old Testament was translated in Alexandria, Egypt in the second century before Jesus. And they had a huge, world-famous library in Alexandria at the time. Unfortunately, it suffered a fire and we lost a lot of documents there. But Philo is in this community in Alexandria, Egypt. He reads Old Testament in Greek, and he's a big fan of Plato. Okay, what Philo does is takes the Old Testament and tries to pull meaning from the Old Testament. You know, the Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, they couldn't offer sacrifices. They couldn't go to the temple consistently. They could only go there for great feasts. And if you were poor, You probably never got to do that. And so Philo's whole thrust is, you know, how can I help my fellow Jews worship God without the sacrificial system? We've got to figure out a way. And so what he did is he takes a philosophical view of the Old Testament and uses allegory and tries to use that to teach the Jews in Egypt. Well, his teachings get spread all over the Greco-Roman world, and they're read everywhere except in Palestine, because the Hebrew-speaking Jews don't think too highly of Philo and his Greek. You know, they believe that was liberal and they didn't like it. Now, why do I bring Philo up? Because it's through Philo that we get the extension of the contemplation of the universe from Plato. Because Philo he loves Plato. But Philo, being a Old Testament believing Jew who believes in Yahweh the Creator, he then takes that idea of contemplating the universe and he wraps it in Old Testament Jewish monotheistic base. Does that make sense? Now, what's interesting is, had it not been for the early church writers of the second and third centuries, none of us would ever have known about Philo. The Jews didn't like him, and the philosophers didn't care for him because he was too Jewish and monotheistic for them. And it was only the early church fathers who loved him that kept his writings alive. And so we have Philo. We have the witness of Philo because of the early church writings. And again, Philo is taking this contemplation idea one step further. He tells us, and he's the only ancient writer to tell us, about this group of Jews that lived in the desert of Alexandria, in the Egyptian desert, and they were referred to as Therapeutai. And they lived like monks in the desert, similar to the monks that lived in the Essenes. Anybody familiar with the group of Jews that lived in the Palestinian caves and deserts in the first century? Well, these were the same kind of Jews, only they lived in the Egyptian desert. And it's only through Philo that we know them. Philo has a bunch of writings. I showed you his exhaustive works. I mean, I don't know how many there are. He probably wrote 40 different treatises. Yeah, 40 or 50 different treatises. He writes about all kinds of things. He's really not that... the ancient writers are really hard to read. They're really verbose. But he has one particular work that I wanted to read from, and it's called The Contemplative Life. So doesn't that... The Contemplative Life. And it's writing about these people that are living in this Egyptian cave. And so if you'll put that next slide up for me, Justin. This is from The Contemplative Life, and he's telling about the worship of these people. Now remember, these are Jews. They're not Christians. They're living in the first century, contemporary of Jesus' day. But this is... So Philo's never heard of Jesus, is telling about the lives of these men and women living in this community out in the desert. He's talking about when they celebrate the Feast of... I think it's the Feast of Weeks. Isn't that where they celebrate every 49 years? It's like, and then they have the Year of Jubilee. You know, anyway, they're all tied together. But look at this. So here he is describing them, and you know, you'll have to forgive me for all the ellipses, but trust me, you don't have to trust me, but when I use the ellipses, I'm cutting out just verbiage that doesn't help us understand. But if you want, you can look him up and you'll know that I'm not taking him out of context. So standing and raising their eyes and their hands to heaven, that reminds you of Plato contemplating the stars. They have learned to fix their attention on what is worthy to look at. Then they sing hymns which have been composed in honor of God, drinking the pure wine of the love of God. Go to the next slide for me, Justin. Drinking the pure wine of the love of God, therefore being intoxicated all night till the morning with this beautiful intoxication, without feeling their heads heavy or closing their eyes for sleep, but being even more awake than when they came to the feast, as to their eyes and their whole bodies, and standing there till morning, when they saw the sun rising, they raised their hands to heaven, imploring for tranquility and truth. And understand, when he talks about intoxication, he's not talking about being drunk. He's talking about being intoxicated with the love of God. I mean, you and I would say they were intoxicated with the Holy Spirit. And Philo actually refers to Holy Spirit, which is mind-boggling to me. But now, what's interesting, what time is it? I'm running out of time. Gosh, I could do this all night. You can read about this in greater depth on my website, because I go into this kind of depth. But what's interesting is the next stage in the development of what we call contemplation or contemplative prayer is the Apostle Paul. Jesus makes some references to it, but it's the Apostle Paul that we get the best picture of it in the New Testament. But there's a missing link from Paul to Philo, or from Philo to Paul. Does anybody know what that missing link would be? Boy, I would be so thrilled if someone could tell me. I mean, it would make my day. In Acts chapter 18, we are told about this young man named Apollos from Alexandria, Egypt. And when he comes, he already knows the gospel according to Jesus. He only knew John's baptism. He didn't know about the baptism in the Holy Spirit, but he knew John's baptism. And he refuted the Jews powerfully, accurately teaching them about the teaching of Jesus. And he's from Alexandria, Egypt. In his description of Apollos, Luke uses a term in the Greek that is a reference to someone who has been skilled in philosophical rhetoric. Some people would disagree with me, but I believe that the missing link between Philo and Paul is brought to Paul through Apollos. I don't know if you remember, but when Paul writes to the church in Corinthians, in Corinth, he says, "Hey, I've heard there's divisions among you. Some say I'm of Paul, some say I'm of Apollos, some say I'm of Peter, and some say, oh yeah, well, I'm of Jesus." And then he says, you know, divisions like this ought not be among you. And he kind of hammers on them. And then in chapter 3, he comes back to that same theme. And he says, for some say, I'm of Paul. And others say, I'm of Apollos. He doesn't mention Peter and Jesus again. And he says, but what is Paul and what is Apollos? We're just servants. If you read in the Acts account, Apollos shows up right after Paul has left Corinth to go to Ephesus. Apollos shows up. And he's met by Priscilla and Aquila, and they teach him more accurately the things of Jesus. And then the Acts account says that Apollos wanted to go to Achaia. Or maybe I got it backwards. Maybe it was right after Paul left Ephesus. I can't remember which city it was, but Paul had gone to another city, and Apollos showed up, and Apollos wanted to go to the region that we know Paul had gone to. And so he was given papers of recommendation, and he set off. Anyway, the point being that when we read the Corinthian letter, we realize that Apollos had significant ministry in Corinth. I think that there's a connection between Philo's understanding of this spiritual Old Testament and Paul's understanding. And I could go into more depth of that, but I'm not going to. I'm whetting your appetite, and you're more than welcome to ask me questions or tell me I'm an idiot if you want to. Because I have good friends who, over in Scotland, whenever they heard me talk about this, they're, oh, no, no. Anyway, so then the next step is the Apostle Paul. Think about Paul. He's on the road to Damascus. He has this incredible encounter with the risen Savior. It completely alters his mind, completely turns him around. And now instead of fighting this Jesus movement, he becomes the biggest advocate for it. And even goes beyond what the leaders of the church were doing. And he takes the gospel to the Gentiles, and he gets in all kinds of trouble. Now there's years in there that he goes and he spends 3 years in the Arabian desert of all things, living a kind of by himself, and he basically says the gospel that I'm teaching, I didn't get it from man, I got it from Jesus, you know, and I'm an apostle because Jesus appointed me. You know, I'm kind of giving you all these references. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul talks about, he says, you know, I know this man who was raised into the third heaven. And he saw and heard things that he's not allowed to talk about. Now, whether this man was in the body or not, I don't know. But all I know is his testimony is true. Now, any New Testament scholar that you read is going to tell you that Paul's talking, because he then goes on and says, well, you know, if these guys who are trying to usurp my authority in Corinth, if they're going to talk about visions, I can talk about visions. So everybody believes that when Paul says he knows a man that was taken to the third heaven, that he's talking about himself. And the terms that he uses in that are very interesting in the Greek. He says, I heard unspeakable things. And so it's paradoxical, even the language that he uses. He heard things that were said that cannot be spoken. Now, you know, what that means, nobody knows. But it's this concept that Paul is communicating that he experienced something while he lived on this earth that was not earthly. Now, you and I would say, well, he had a vision. Or maybe God gave him a glimpse of heaven. What you need to realize, though, is that those are the foundational understandings of contemplation, of contemplative prayer. It's the idea. Remember we talked about, those of you who are here for the Ephesians study, Paul says, and this is part of why I believe that he's been influenced, in the Ephesians letter he says, for we are seated with Christ in the heavenlies. And that's the idea of contemplative prayer, is that you extract yourself away from this earth to be somehow in your mind supernaturally in the presence of God. Now, that's in a strict sense what contemplative prayer is. And part of the reason I like Brother Lawrence is because he makes it a lot more rational and easy to grasp. I mean, when I read some of the other church fathers about, you know, contemplative prayer, I'm like, I mean, it's so otherworldly that you wonder, how could you ever do this, you know? And so I like Brother Lawrence because he brings it more down to our level. But, and then if you look at, oh yeah, I did have the theory of Paul's connection through Apollos. I forgot I put that on there. Well, then if you look in Paul's, the one text I'm going to read for you is out of Colossians. Justin, if you can put the next slide up. Colossians 3:15 through 17, interestingly enough, is a mirror text of Ephesians chapter 5 that we looked at in our last class. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you are called to peace, and be thankful. And you'll notice I've kind of highlighted in bold the things that I think are pointing us towards this idea of contemplative prayer. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom, and as you sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God. You remember the Ephesian text says, as you sing songs and hymns and spiritual songs to one another. In the Colossians text, it's singing these songs, and if you take Paul literally, which, you know, I'm not saying that you have to, but if you take him literally, he's saying you're singing these songs in your heart. I point to my head because, you know, in the Greek, your heart is the center of who you are. And, maybe it's my academic nature, but for me, if I think about my heart, I connect it to my head. You know, now I know that that's not absolutely the case, right? Because sometimes I feel things in my heart that don't make any sense in my head, right? Sometimes God calls us to, you know, in the face of great tragedy, you can have the peace of Christ in your heart that passes all understanding. In your mind, you're like, man, it doesn't make sense. I ought to be upset, but I'm not, you know. So I know that they're different. I pointed to my head because, you know, that I betrayed myself. know, I live too much in my Christian life probably here than I do from my heart. But, you know, that's, of course, why you need Brother Lawrence. That's why I need him so, is to get it out of here and let it get down in here. Okay, moving right along. Then we come to the second century, and I'm gonna really whiz through this, even though this is what I love, you know, a great deal, is Clement of Alexandria writing in Egypt, second century Christian church father. He loves Plato and he loves Philo. He quotes from them all the time, from Plato and Philo, yet he quotes from the Apostle Paul more than twice as much as those two combined. So I like to point that out. Just because he likes Plato and Philo doesn't mean that, you know, we would say that he's, you know, dubious, although he is dubious in some ways. But Clement of Alexandria talks about silent prayer. He talks about the Christian has this ability to pray inwardly without vocalizing it. Now, you and I probably, that's no, you know, that doesn't surprise us. But if you remember back in the Old Testament, there's a story of Hannah when she goes to, remember, she can't have children, and she goes into the temple, and Eli the priest sees her moving her lips, but he's not hearing anything out of her mouth. Well, in the Jewish tradition, you never prayed without being vocal. That was just, and I would tell you that in the early Christian tradition, it's the same way. Prayer was vocalized. It was not internalized as a general rule. And so Eli sees her moving her lips and not making any noise, and he thinks she's drunk and something's wrong with her. You know, well, what's happening is she's praying within herself. But I use that text only to show you that it was an unusual thing, even in the Old Testament, to pray inwardly. And that's the development we have. Do you see the development where Paul talks about singing in your heart? And then we have this church father, Clement of Alexandria, who's talking about praying in your mind silently. I mean, Clement has a great verse. I like it. He says that the true believer thinks a thought and God gives him his desire. He just thinks a thought and God moves in his life. Now, I'm going to tell you that I think that is kind of part of this contemplative prayer idea. That when you think, you can be praying. Now, you remember some of us talked about, you know, I grew up talking to myself, and all my life, I talked to myself. And then I came to a place in my Christian life where I decided, okay, Lord, I need you to help me. Instead of talking to myself, I want that to be prayer. You know, and so I started trying to discipline myself, and that all came from Brother Lawrence. To make my thinking and my talk, well, no, I'm going to take talking to myself to make that prayer. The next step was when I'm thinking to myself to make that prayer as well. So we see this trajectory moving towards a, now, you know, you can call it spiritualized prayer. I don't know. You can call it any number of things. But anyway. Oh, and then the last thing is Clement's writings are the foundation for the monastic movement. The guys that lived in the Egyptian desert, the very first monks, it is said that many of them had the writings of Clement and the New Testament and Origen sitting in their cave. And that, those are the only things they read, the New Testament and Clement of Alexandria, and some of them read Origen. So it's the foundation of what we find in the monastic movement. Next slide, please. In the monastic tradition, what we find is that prayer is commingled or intermingled with work. You know, you typically in a monastic setting, you would get up at 6 a.m., you'd have an hour of prayer, and then you'd go eat breakfast, and then you'd go to work. You'd work for several hours, then you'd come back for an hour of prayer, then you'd eat lunch, then you'd go to work for another several hours, then you'd come back in for an hour of prayer, then you'd eat dinner, then you'd have rest for 2 or 3 hours, and then you know the bells would ring again at midnight to get up and have prayer again. But prayer and work were intermingled in the monastic movement. Silence and solitude and contemplation were always encouraged in the monastic movement. You can think of the things that we've already talked about, contemplation, this contemplative prayer, and you might agree with me that that's probably easier to do when you're alone and when you're being quiet. Now, I don't know about everybody else, but for me, That was the only way for me to learn how to do contemplative prayer. I had to get myself alone. I had to get away from distraction. I couldn't have radio and television and people talking and, you know, Heather in the kitchen asking me what I want for dinner. And, you know, I had to just get away and be completely isolated and be quiet so that I could learn this art of praying in my heart and letting it just come out. It's actually hard to describe, but Brother Lawrence is going to help us, and we're going to talk more about it as we go. Now, and I just put up here, contemplation. You know, the definition of contemplation. I mean, we think about this. If you contemplate something, it means you're thinking very deeply about it. You can contemplate a mathematical problem. How many of you are engineers or computer guys, and you know, mathematics are big time in your... Anybody, come on. Okay. You know what Plato said about mathematics? Plato says mathematics and music are the two most pure art forms in the world. It's the closest thing to understanding the language of eternity. Music and math. Why? Because A plus B, if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, those are ideas. In the Greek, the word ideas that represent something. You know, alpha and beta, those little letters, represent something, right? And so Plato says those get you to think outside this world. A plus B makes you think. You can't think about a chair. You're thinking about something else that's abstract. So that's how I encourage my daughters not to hate math, or at least to try when they hated math. My dad was an engineer, and I used to always tell him, I'll never use this. And, you know, what he needed to do was tell me, oh, yes, you will use it. You may not be an engineer, but it's teaching you how to think abstractly. And that's why you need to learn math. And quite honestly, you guys, I believe that's part of the dumbing down of America. People can't think anymore because we don't promote mathematics like we used to when I was growing up. You weren't forced to memorize. You know, and we kind of think, oh, memorization. Well, yeah, memorization is kind of the groundwork of learning. And if you can't think abstractly, then it's real easy to believe what some guy says on the news. And if he says it over and over again, you'll just believe it. Because you haven't learned how to think critically, how to argue against concepts. Anyway, that's a soapbox issue, so I'll move on. All right, Brother Lawrence. Let's go to Brother Lawrence. This is all introductory stuff. I hope I'm not boring you to death. And by the way, we won't be doing any of this from this point, but I felt it important, instead of just jumping right to 17th century Carmelite monk in France, that you should know some of how this, you know, developed. I will make reference to it as we go, but I won't focus on it like I did tonight. Brother Lawrence lived in the 17th century, and he was a Carmelite monk. Now, for those of you who don't know, you know, the Reformation occurs in the 16th century, the early 16th century, through Martin Luther. John Calvin comes along later, but Martin Luther is who we always look at it as the beginning of the Reformation. You know, Martin Luther never wanted to leave the Catholic Church, right? He wanted the Catholic Church to change, and the Catholic Church said, no, thank you, we don't want you anymore. But what happened was a lot of monks, especially in the university environment, agreed with Martin Luther about a great many things, about the excesses in the priesthood. And so there arose a movement within the Catholic Church, and we call it the Counter-Reformation. And it mainly took place in the next century, in the 17th century, so in the 1600s is when it mainly took place. It probably started in the late 1500s. But in this Counter-Reformation, a lot of the monastic orders started being reformed. You know, the monks would start looking at their own little communities and going, you know what? We've gotten soft. We've gone away from the teachings of, you know, whoever it was that started their monastic order. And so there was a real call all through the Catholic Church to get back to basics. Now, some of the basics they went back to were, unfortunately, not New Testament basics, you know. And they did a lot of things that, you know, you and I would completely disagree with. I mean, they gathered up Protestants and burned them at the stake and burned their New Testaments. And, you know, that's really difficult for me not to judge them on that. You know what I mean? It's real difficult for me to say, oh, they were believers. They just were misguided. It's hard for me to do that, and I don't do that. But I also have to urge that we not just judge them, because quite frankly, the early reformers did the same thing to the Catholics. In St. Andrews, where I lived, John Knox, who happens to be an ancestor of my wife Heather, she's in the direct lineage of John Knox, he lived in Crail, 9 miles from St. Andrews, and he heard, you know, the cardinal of the Catholic Church had burned one of his friends at the stake, and he riled up the church there, and they marched 9 miles into St. Andrews, and they started tearing down the Catholic, I mean, literally ripping the idols off, not the idols, but you know what I mean, the statues of the saints that they called idols. They started ripping them down and pulling there was a big cathedral in St. Andrews, 150 yards long, as an awesome edifice. And John Knox and his buds just tore it down and started, you know, attacking the Catholics and beating them and killed some of them. And so, you know, we have to be careful as Protestants to judge the Catholics, because the Protestant reformers did the same things, you know. It's a different age. I don't know if they're saved or not. I'm not worried about that. I can't. That's not my bag, you know. God's going to judge all of us. I just want to be right, you know. I'll let him sort out John Knox and all those guys. Anyway, so Brother Lawrence is in this movement of the Carmelite tradition that is being reformed, and it's called the Discalced. Is that up there? Yeah, Discalced. So the Carmelites, and John of the Cross is I believe, the one who formed the Discalced branch of the Carmelites. Discalced means unshoed. So what happened was, I don't know if it was John of the Cross or who it was, but they said, you know what, we've become too soft in the Carmelite monastic order, so we're going to reform it. So the first thing we're going to do is nobody can wear any shoes, ever. So they went around without shoes on. Now, you know, you and I might think that's not a big deal, but, you know, we live in the age of carpet and smooth concrete. You know, so a lot of those guys probably have broken toes and a lot of calluses on the bottoms of their feet. But anyway, Brother Lawrence, I'm going to read to you, and then we're going to be done. But I'm going to read to you a short biography that I found on Brother Lawrence that I really liked and the way it was presented. So let me read it to you. Brother Lawrence, 1614 to 1691. So he lived almost the entire 17th century. Brother Lawrence was born Nicholas Herman in modern-day Eastern France. He received a revelation of the providence and power of God at the age of 18, but it would be another 6 years before he joined the Discalced Carmelite prior in Paris. In the intervening year, he fought in the 30 Years' War. So here he was, a Christian, fighting in the 30 Years' War. Nicholas entered the priory in Paris as a layman, not having any education to be a priest, and he took the religious name Lawrence of the Resurrection. He spent almost the rest of his life within the walls of this monastery, working in the kitchen for most of his life and also repairing sandals in the latter years. Yet despite, or perhaps because of this, his somewhat lowly position, his character attracted many people. He was known for a profound peace, and many came to seek spiritual guidance from him. The wisdom that he passed on to them in conversations and in letters would later become the basis for the book, The Practice of the Presence of God. This work was compiled after Brother Lawrence died by one of those whom he had inspired, Father Joseph de Beaufort, however you say it, the later Vicar General to the Archbishop of Paris. It became popular among Catholics and Protestants alike, the book. John Wesley and A.W. Tozer both recommended it highly. While he was in the army, Brother Lawrence had a vision. So this is before he joined the Carmelites. In the deepest winter, Lawrence looked at a barren tree stripped of all its leaves and fruit, and he waited silently and patiently, thinking that soon summer would arrive. You know, it was cold and nasty, and he wanted summer to arrive. Gazing at the tree, Herman grasped for the first time the extravagance of God's grace and the unfailing sovereignty of divine providence. Like the tree, he himself was seemingly dead, but God had life waiting for him, and in turn of seasons would bring him into a fullness. At that very moment, Lawrence said in his heart that the leafless tree flashed upon his soul the fact that God loved him, a love that would never leave him afterwards. Sometime later, he was injured. He was a foot soldier, and he was injured, and that's why he was crippled. He was crippled and couldn't do much work at all. And that's why he ended up going to a monastery. He sought a place. Listen to this. This is Catholic, typical Catholic thinking. He went to this discalced monastery looking for a place where he could suffer for his sins. He wanted to suffer for his many sins. He was assigned to the kitchen where, amidst the tedious chores of cooking and cleaning, at the constant bidding of his superiors, he developed his rule of spirituality and work. And this is a quote from him. "We can do little things for God. When I turn the pancake in the pan, I do it for the love of God. If there's nothing else he calls me to, I prostrate myself before him who has given me grace to be able to work. Afterwards, I will arise happier than a king. It is enough for me to pick up straw from the ground for my love of God." Brother Lawrence retreated to a place in his heart where the love of God made every detail of his life of surpassing value. "I began to live as if there were no one else on the earth except for me and God. Together, God and Brother Lawrence cooked meals, ran errands, scrubbed pots, and endured the scorn of the world." He admitted that the path to this perfect union was not easy. He spent years disciplining his heart and mind to yield to God's presence. And this is another quote. "As often as I could, I would place myself as a worshiper before him, fixing my mind upon his holy presence, recalling my mind when I found it wandering away. This proved to be an exercise frequently painful, yet I persisted through all difficulty." What happened was this, how much time do I have here? Yeah, I'm almost done. So what happened was, a monk came for a retreat and he wanted to take his meals in his room and not eat with the monks, which is common. If you go to a monastery for spiritual retreat, the monks actually want you to come and eat with them and share the meal with them. It's a tradition, a long-held tradition for Christians to fellowship over a meal. But this particular man wanted to be alone. He just felt the need to be alone. And so Brother Lawrence started delivering his meals to him. And in the process of him being there in spiritual retreat, he started talking to Brother Lawrence. And this cook, you know, in a monastery you have the abbot and you have the elders, and there's a real pecking order of, you know, who the spiritual leaders are. The cook is normally not a spiritual leader. But the man was so struck by Brother Lawrence and his spirit and his love and his grace that he conversed with him, and then he exchanged letters with him asking Brother Lawrence to tell me the secret of your communion with Christ. And that's how the book is written, is the man saved the letters that Brother Lawrence wrote him. And then after Brother Lawrence died, he published them. And it's become a Christian classic. We're really done, aren't we? Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to order these books. If I got your email, I will send you the online version and you can begin to read from Brother Lawrence. But if you don't read anything from next week, it doesn't matter, because we're going to do a little bit more of introductory stuff next week about the actual conceptual, how do you do this? How do you even begin to do this? And I'm going to go by my own experience, which is the one I know best. But every week, starting next week, I'm going to stop at 8 o'clock and we're going to have 10 minutes where we're going to just spread out in here, and we're going to try to practice this art of stilling, you know, quieting your heart and your mind and just sitting before God. And I'll explain more about that next week. But that's part of what we're going to do every time we meet, is have a time where we're all going to do that and practice this discipline of being in the presence of God, okay?